Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
And we have to start off today by saying thank you to all of our listeners around the world who have messaged us, emailed us to say congratulations on 5 years of Science Unscripted. We celebrated that last week.
Do we read them all out? Because we'd be here for a while if we did that.
That'd be the whole show. And it'd be really, really deeply self-indulgent.
We're going to have to do at least one. You're holding a letter in your hand right now?
Yeah, so one of these is...
Although we don't know whether it's 5 years or not, because we haven't opened it yet.
That's true. So we have a letter, and this letter says... I think it's in connection with it, because we aired it, and this has a sticker on it that says Air Mail Par Avion. This is from Canada, and addressed to Mr. Connor... This part, we didn't even discuss this. Addressed to Mr. Connor Dillon, clearly me, and in quotation marks, Gabe. As if Gabe were an alter ego or a pseudonym. I'm going to rip it open. This is from Carol White with a couple of stamps on it. It's a postcard.
Postcard,
and it says, Connor and Gabe... Enjoy your shows. Thank you for your professionalism and authenticity. Sometimes at 3:30 a.m.
It doesn't cease to amaze me how many Canadian listeners we have, because our show runs on the CBC, that's their national broadcaster, in the middle of the night.
That's the part that...
Across the country.
That's the part that gets me.
So we have so many Canadians writing into us.
We have rebroadcasters all around the world. Airing our shows at various times in various places. We receive random emails from people who are driving their car somewhere or were on a bus somewhere, and they write to us saying, hey, thanks. And then it alerts us to the fact that we're being broadcasted there. But yeah, the really interesting part is the difficult time slot that a lot of you endure on our behalf.
Yeah.
Thank you.
There is one I just have to read. It's from a woman named Christina, who wrote, congrats on 5 years of the show. And then she detailed why she looks forward to every episode and called our show unique. And then she has 4 points. Can I just read these all out? Because they're...
Please.
They make me feel so good. Okay. Your voices are soothing, and however the show is produced is easy to listen to.
Thanks today to Jürgen Kuhn. He's our studio technician who makes that happen. He was just adjusting our microphones to make us sound better. So thanks, Jürgen.
Point two, your banter and ability to talk about serious issues and then joke almost boyishly is kind of wholesome. It's definitely fun, especially when Gabe says something that could be perceived as inappropriate. And there's this pause where Connor is processing and then either laughs or comes in with some kind of parental teacher response. I just love you two together. It's good comedy and rapport. Three, obviously the science. I like the questions you ask about the studies you're reading. The relaxed, non-jargon language you use keeps the show accessible for me. Regardless of what energy level I have, it's not too much, not too little. You've Goldilocked it.
Ooh, that's a good use of that. Really good use of that word.
And last point, you both seem like great people. I like that you care about other humans and you're not afraid to show that. There's so much negative, inhumane stuff out there. I don't want any more of it, but I still want facts and science. I get real Tom Hanks, Morgan Freeman vibes every time I listen. Then in parentheses, hope you know what I mean, just going off their movie characters.
Yeah,
since I've never actually met the men.
Who has? Nobody has.
I haven't.
Most people haven't.
I've seen You've Got Mail and The Shawshank Redemption. But
Sleepless in Seattle? That was a good one, too. Thank you to
13.
Christina.
Christina.
Christina, thank you very much. Thank you to Carol. Thank you again to all of the people who took time in to write us to wish us happy birthday, happy fifth birthday of the show. Onward and forward we go to a very important topic. It's not a scientific study per se that we're going to talk about now, but
but it is a topic. The journal Nature put out a poll last week, and ever since, 1,650 researchers in the U.S. are the only ones who had access to this poll. 1,650 took part, and 1,200 said yes to the following question. Are you a U.S. researcher who is considering leaving the country following the disruptions to science prompted by the Trump administration? 75.3% said yes.
This is in connection with headlines that many of you may have seen already, which is that the quote-unquote brain drain is underway, that a series of policy announcements by the Trump administration in the United States.
Well, the big one, right? Radical transparency about wasteful spending. That was an executive order by the president that announced that there's going to be a freeze on NIH, National Institutes of Health funding for government funding for research. It was going to be frozen. That's 1.5 billion euros that was going to scientists. Work that was underway was just going to be stopped. A judge has since blocked those canceled grants, but not all of them. So there are scientists who are in a kind of limbo at the moment, it's a good word, disruptions to science. It's not being blocked
uncertainty.
Or stopped. It's just, it's being disrupted.
Well, for those scientists, then you have one of the more recent announcements from the National Institute of Health that 10,000 jobs Department of Health and Human Services, 10,000 jobs would be cut. These are people who are directly losing their livelihoods. Of mm-hmm. course, in those situations, you're looking for opportunities elsewhere, and those are not necessarily the same people who were interviewed or surveyed as nature. But a lot of people in the United States right now are looking for other options.
Yeah, in the same week, there was a letter issued by the U.S. National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine. Those are three different academies. 2,000 researchers on those academies have signed a letter criticizing the policies of the administration. And this is one paragraph out of this letter that has, again, been signed by 2,000 researchers, which does not reflect the views of those academies or the host institutions of these 2,000 researchers. But still, here it is. A climate of fear has descended on the research community. Researchers, afraid of losing their funding or job security, are removing their names from publications, abandoning studies, and rewriting grant proposals and papers to remove scientifically accurate terms that agencies are flagging as objectionable. Although some in the scientific community have protested vocally, most researchers, universities, research institutions, and professional organizations have kept silent to avoid antagonizing the administration and jeopardizing their funding.
So they're calling out their institutions, telling them to do more? Yeah,
Of fear.
Yeah.
Among researchers in the United States.
A couple of weeks ago, I mentioned on this show a Max Planck researcher who was corresponding with one of his colleagues in the United States, and the colleague in the U.S. wanted to switch communication channels due to fears that the organization's email address or the email account he was using with that organization could be compromised, that he couldn't say what he needed to say because it might be reviewed. And the German researcher said, I've seen that before, but it was with Chinese colleagues and not with U.S. colleagues. A lot of stuff is happening. It's too much to talk about. I'm not sure we need to talk about any more of it now, except the proposed, in quotation marks, solution to this, or one thing you're hearing a lot of here in Germany and in Europe, is that the brain drain means they're coming here. Are they? That's been the big question. We've been talking about this for weeks, Gabe, because
right.
there have been headlines, but there hasn't been any information.
We mentioned that one of our colleagues is doing this story and has reached out to the big four.
The big four.
The four research and scientific institutions in Germany, Max Planck, which we spoke about last week, Helmholtz, Fraunhofer,
Leibniz.
And Leibniz.
Right. Three of the four replied back to him that they were not willing to comment yet. This is different than a denial. We're never going to talk. They didn't do that. They just said, look, happy to talk. Yeah, happy to talk to you. We don't have information yet, so we're not going to talk to you. One of the big four scientific institutions here in Germany said, we'll talk to you, but we don't really have much information yet. And that was Helmholtz. The Helmholtz Association, just real quickly, has more than 46,000 employees and an annual budget of 6 billion euros. It's huge, absolutely huge. And the president, his name is Otmar Wiestler, talked to DW about this. And I'm just going to play you one clip where his answer surprised me. There's a lot of, you know, we're not certain, don't know exactly what's going to happen in the future, and we don't want to speculate. One clip I thought was very interesting because he was sort of implying this isn't just going to have an effect on U.S. researchers.
Für eine fundierte Analyse von möglichen Auswirkungen auf die Rekrutierung in unseren Zentren.
Regarding the potential effects on our recruitment centers, it's still too early for any kind of thorough analysis. But as a place of research, Germany is fundamentally an attractive alternative to the US, regardless of recent developments. We can therefore assume that international researchers will increasingly consider careers in Germany. That applies not only to scientists who are currently employed in the US, but to talented researchers from around the globe, who are now looking for alternatives to an intended or previously planned stay in the US. As a side note, we did see a similar trend after Brexit.
Eine ähnliche Tendenz haben wir im Übrigen nach dem Brexit gesehen.
Yeah, and again, that was the president of the German Helmholtz Institute. Pointing out something I just never thought of, which is, of course, if you're a researcher thinking about going to the U.S. and things are uncertain there, or a quote-unquote climate of fear, then you will reconsider and possibly end up in Germany or Europe as or elsewhere as a result.
But then again, like a good scientist, he was careful with his words. It is too early to make any predictions about what's going to, or why would you do that? You have to wait and see what happens. And again, when I quoted that, the survey in the journal Nature, 1,650 researchers, there are 1.8 million people in science in the US. So that is a very, very small sliver of all of the scientists. But still, I think it's good that we address this now at this point. Give it the seriousness
well,
that it deserves.
Not only that, but not the to avoid the hyperbole, there was some glee, some schadenfreude, to use a German word, when there was news that in France, one of the institutes or universities had already, you know, been drawing in quotation marks all these U.S. researchers, and it turned out that three had come. That's not newsworthy to me. And yet it was repeated as if, oh, look, you know, everyone's coming.
Yeah, there's a lot of hype going on right now. That has to be
said.
Yeah,
that is not true yet.
What do you guys have to say about the situation? There's a lot going on at the moment. And yeah.
It's hard to keep track of. It really is hard to keep track of all the cuts and all the things that have changed in the scientific landscape, medical landscape in the United States.
Are you affected by any of it? Are you personally affected by any of this? Let us know anything about the situation with an email to su@dw.com.
Okay, we are going to switch now to, I was going to say a dark topic. It's possibly the darkest, one of the darkest. It's suicide. And the most important thing to say before we get into a study on that is that if you are having thoughts of death or wanting to die, those are thoughts that a lot of people have at some point in their lives or have had in their lives. There are hotlines all around the world, your country almost certainly has one where you can call anonymously and talk to a professional about those thoughts, about what you're going through. You can also talk to your general practitioner or your doctor. There are telemedicine options as well. At the very least, family members, friends, loved ones, somewhere there is someone willing to listen to you and what you're going through and who can help you. That's the most important thing we can say, not just right now, but in connection with the interview you're about to hear.
The topic is suicide today. And what group of people do you think is at the highest risk? That might come as a shocker. But also that for that group, there is the least support out there, at least on the internet, in the digital realm.
Science Unscripted.
My name is Ipsit Vahia. I'm the chief of geriatric psychiatry at McLean Hospital and affiliated with Harvard Medical School. I study mental health and well-being in older adults, and my colleagues and I recently published a paper on the topic of suicide in late life.
And Ipsit, what did you find out in that work on the elderly and suicide?
So we approach our research through the lens of technology and media. Our work focused on understanding how resources for suicide prevention are accessible to an older adult that may be searching for them. And we found that most major organizations that work in this space don't do a great job of making these resources easily accessible to older adults.
Is this because, and I'm gonna sort of invoke a prejudice that I have or a cliche that I have. Is this because the elderly have a more difficult time using online resources? Is it as simple as they can't find websites that they need to find, or what's going on?
So we considered that. The way we designed the study was to try and replicate how someone that is older might look for information, which is usually a simple Google search. And then we aggregated what a Google search for suicide and aging or suicide prevention shows up. And then we looked at the websites on the first page, because that is all that most people will usually look at. And based on the organizations that appeared on the first page, we analyzed their content. It was quite shocking. We actually then had four people on our team conduct the search independently to confirm that what we were seeing was really what we were seeing. And then I did the whole search myself, because something this striking, you don't just publish it without being fully certain of your findings.
And how did you determine that help for suicide prevention was aimed at younger people and not at older people? What exactly did you find?
So we first restricted our search to major not-for-profits or federal government websites that had this information. We looked at whether they identified older adults as a high-risk population, which 5 out of the 7 did. But then we talked about whether they mentioned any specific public health campaigns or if they included resources targeting older adults. And we found that the vast majority of them did not. Only 2 out of the 7 contained a resource targeting a specific population. So it was very broad and very general. And if someone older were looking at it, they would not at first glance find information that they would see applicable to them.
And this is going to sound like a provocative question, but I think if I understood your research correctly, it's not. Is it such a big problem in the elderly? Because I think my default assumption, or when I hear talk of suicide, I tend to think of younger people in middle age. How significant is this in the elderly?
Older adults, particularly those aged 75 or older, have the highest rates of completed suicide of any age group. And these rates have continued to rise over the past 20 years. So it's actually especially important, because suicide rates have been declining in younger age groups. But among older adults, they have always been the highest, and they're continuing to rise. And this is a major issue that we feel has not really been addressed or not really been spotlighted adequately. And what we found on these public-facing websites seems to sort of confirm it.
Ipsit, I'm scared of even saying these words in this question that's coming, but does this mean that society doesn't care about these people, or cares less about the elderly than young people? Or
you ask a provocative question, and I think I have to give the provocative answer, which is possibly. We know that ageism, not conscious but subliminal ageism, is an issue in access to health, in providing support to older adults. We think it's not just ageism. We think that there are other biases perhaps at play as well, that people with disabilities, for example, are often left out of information campaigns. We think that in general, whenever there is an absence of information, that some biases, implicit or explicit, are at play. And it's hard not to at least wonder about it or ask these questions when you look at findings like ours.
I'm trying to put myself in the body of a 75-year-old. I mean, I'm in my 40s, and I know that I'm not physically what I was 20 years ago. And if I extrapolate on that, it's just going to get worse. How? What is that? Is that physiological decline what leads to the decline in mental health within that age group, or is there something that I just can't even imagine that's happening there? What is it based on the research?
I actually think it's not quite as simple as that. I actually think it's related to the fact that a lot of depression drives this, and that depression in late life is often under-recognized and under-treated. So again, there are a lot of social and psychological factors at play, but I think we know that the biggest driver of suicide is actually psychiatric illness, and most commonly depression. About 85% of completed suicide is in people that have diagnosable depression. So I think there's a broader under-recognition of mental health challenges for older adults, and these are under-treated. That probably is the single biggest driver of these suicide statistics.
Is there a straightforward answer for why older people are so depressed, or why depression hits them so hard?
I don't think there is a straightforward answer. I think it's probably too complicated for us to get into all the nuances. But I think the simplest version is that depression looks different in older adults than it does in younger adults. So older adults don't always present with, the tearfulness or that sense of hopelessness. It's more lack of energy, lack of motivation, lack of enthusiasm, sort of withdrawing from their social networks and social connections. So because of this, it's not always picked up by clinicians because it's not easy to see. And older adults will not always even recognize it themselves, so they don't always bring it up. And it's more complicated because other common illnesses like high blood pressure or diabetes can also lead to these symptoms. So it's a little harder to pick up. And I think it's that under-recognition of these differences in early and late depression that's a big part of this.
And yet, despite that lack of energy, they are really good or effective at suicide. 1 in 4, I read, compared to 1 in 200 attempts by adolescents when it comes to suicide attempts. 1 in 4, why are they so effective at it?
If you look at the statistics, most of the completed suicide in older adults are men, not women, even though women live longer. And we know that across the lifespan, women are more likely to have suicide thoughts, but men are more likely to actually complete a suicide attempt. So it's disproportionately men. And we know that older men use more violent means as part of a suicide attempt. So we think that it's a combination of factors that are probably driving this.
I feel like I never hear about this, honestly, Ipsit. Are families hiding this because it's sad and embarrassing to talk about the fact that that's the way that grandpa or great grandpa died? Am I right in my
like is it a taboo or?
Yeah, in my like subjective feeling that when we hear about suicide, it's the tragic loss of life in a younger or middle-aged person, and that it's somewhat hidden societally when it occurs. Apparently, a lot in people over the age of 75.
It isn't something that we've studied specifically, but I think to your point, this is somewhat of an understudied topic. That, you know, we have the statistics to show that this is happening, but not quite enough research to identify why or whether there are specific points of intervention. What we do know is that a lot of older adults that complete suicide, they're not who you might imagine. These are not people that are isolated or living by themselves. It's often people that live with family. It's often people that have seen their clinicians within the past month. So we think that there is an element where this is not being screened for as proactively as it needs to be, and probably not being treated for that result. But it isn't talked about as much as it probably should be, and certainly not as much as the statistics require it to be.
My grandpa lost his wife of more than 50 years just within the last 2 years. And he's probably part of the risk group that you're talking about right now. my question is, what are three things I should look for to figure out whether or not he really is at risk? And then what could I do or my family members do? And also, what should, it sounds silly, but at the technological level, what should society be doing to help him sitting in this assisted living facility?
First of all, my condolences to your family and you. But I think you ask a good and timely question. It really starts with just asking how he's doing and how he's coping. Seeing if he might be lonely or isolated. If he's at an assisted living facility, actually, he probably has more social contact and communication than if he were living by himself. I also think that we don't ask the direct question about, are you having thoughts of death or dying, or have you had thoughts of perhaps ending it all? A lot of older adults don't express this, but they will communicate it if it is asked. And as in any age group, if someone expresses thoughts of death or dying, pay attention, because it might be an opportunity to save a life.
What's the first step for them to possibly prevent it?
Ask for help. I think if someone is having these thoughts, ask for help. It will be available.
That was Ipsit Vahia speaking to us from Boston.
With advice, I'm going to take one-to-one with me this summer when I hopefully, not hopefully, I'm going to the U.S. and will visit my grandpa. And yeah, I mean, it sounds so easy and clear when he says it, just ask. It feels like a social breach, right? I'm the younger one. You're the elderly person I respect and don't ask that question of, but I should, everyone should.
I have never asked that question of anyone.
Would you?
If I had reason to believe that they were in danger of killing themselves, yeah, I hope I would. But I know what you mean. It's a hard question to ask. Hey, do you want to die?
It feels embarrassing. Like,
it's almost absurd. It's an absurd question.
It feels like both parties' faces would turn red. But I guess that's what he's saying. Find the courage to turn your own face red and the other person's face red and go through that embarrassment to talk about something that is really, really important and can make a lot of things better just by going through that initial awkward phase. So thank you to Ipsit, to all of you for listening to what we think is a really important topic, one that's been under-discussed. At least that was my impression. I meant that when I was saying I don't hear about this. I hadn't heard about this.
Was it on your guys' radar out there? What do you have to share here? Send it to us at su@dw.com. We'd love to hear it.
Science Unscripted.
DW, made for minds.